Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 325 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we have Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Oh.
Didn't say on the line though.
Yeah, no.
Like that. Alrighty, well it's been a few moons since we had a last show. We did two Clubhouse events, which people didn't come to, but that's okay. Clubhouse is new, but for those of you who don't know, we do have a Clubhouse club called MTJC iOS Development, and if you ping us, I have a few invites to give out, so we can set some Clubhouse stuff up there. But with that in mind, Jaime has a follow-up from our first Clubhouse meeting.
Yeah, I actually will throw in a real-time follow-up or real-time fact-check, I guess, because almost certainly somebody will be, you know, a wise person and say, well, it hasn't been that many moons, it's only been one. And that's actually true. Although the intent of your statement there was, you know, more accurate than the literal take on it. So,
because there's only one moon or a 28-day cycle. Where are you going?
Yeah, because we haven't reached more than fractional moons beyond one.
You're going okay.
New moons.
Okay, then maybe I should have said sleeps, right? Then instead of moons, right?
Sleeps.
Just a way of counting,
a lot of
counting
sleeps.
The days. Alrighty, we have to go fact check that because I don't know actually when the expression how many moons it's been, whether it's actually are they counting 28-day cycles as in months or are they counting individual days, which is what I always thought it was. Developers. Okay, carry on.
Alrighty. So on the Clubhouse, I think I had made the statement about Jenkins being originally named Hudson, which is the name that I first remember getting involved for, you know, what Jenkins does. And we didn't know why on the air for that, but I looked it up. So Wikipedia has the answer here that the Jenkins project was originally named Hudson and was renamed after a dispute with Oracle, which had forked the project and claimed rights to the project name. So
apparently Jenkins is still a free open source tool that people could use?
Yeah, and it was free and open source when it was Hudson, and then I didn't follow the, you know, we'll have the links in the show notes for those of you driving at home who really want to dig into what I assume is the drama related to Oracle having some sort of claimed rights over the project name. I mean, this was a fair amount ago, so the open source community has changed quite a bit in the intervening, or the subsequent decade. So Hudson's no longer maintained, so Oracle's Hudson is obsolete as of February of 2017, but Jenkins is still going strong.
So for those of people who don't know what Jenkins is, it basically, I mean, the way I know of it is we use it for doing our Xcode builds, right? Like we have a bunch of servers that have Xcode on them and they run, you know, Xcode build commands, right? Is that what people are using Jenkins for? Do you know?
People are still using it for continuous integration, continuous delivery type stuff. not my area of expertise to sort of really tease apart whether it truly fits both of those. But sort of anecdotally, when people are like, oh, what do you use for CI/CD? Usually an answer is Jenkins, right? Like, okay, you know, we've got our Android project being built off of this, iOS projects, web deployments and other things might go through Jenkins. There's other tools out there. Again, not my area of expertise, but sort of a, you know, pretty basic thing that somebody will have if they have continuous integration or continuous delivery at all, meaning they're not doing it off of somebody's laptop. Probably Jenkins at a minimum. They might have other things, of course.
Yeah. I'm safe in saying that, you know, it allows you to build print or like queues of jobs that you send your builds over to. Let me just think how you do that. I guess, yeah, it ties in with our Bitbucket, right? And, you know, when you create a PR, it runs off and takes it and runs a build with a specific configuration that we use for publishing or for development testing and stuff like that, right? And, you know, you can put in certificates and have it signed. It's kind of a workflow deal where you can create these pipelines that will take the commands and basically run specific builds. So you can create custom builds. Like if you need to make a build that, you know, has this data set in it or something like that, or this signed with this certificate or as opposed to that certificate, you can set up queues for that kind of stuff. And like you said, you can have it do the Android build and the Xcode build. And I think even Java builds at the same time, like for Node.js and stuff like that. I don't know if they publish one of those JVM sort of things, right? You can set up Jenkins with a bunch of scripts to do that kind of stuff. So that's what it does. That's why it's used for continuous integration and stuff like that, right? So
yeah, it's got a bunch of plugins that let you do other things. It is sort of the jack of all trades and master of none in terms of there being, you know, better, more focused tools for some of the pieces that Jenkins is trying to do. But if, you know, again, for the kiddos out there, they're like, oh, everything's in the cloud and click, click, click. Like, let me tell you, having worked in places in my career where literally if this one laptop had fallen into the river, we would not have been able to ship our software and getting things through the, okay, at the very least, source control is in the cloud. Okay, great. Now, the next thing is, can we get a clean build server that's not my laptop to be able to do builds from? So the, you know, it works on my machine problem tends to go away. And again, you run, you know, when you run something like Jenkins, you have some sort of repeatable build that you can do. You don't have to worry about this thing fell in the river and, oh no, we have to spend a week to a month trying to figure out how this build process works, right? It helps you with that. There's, you know, tests that you can run, automated scripts and et cetera, but it's actually taking me back here thinking about this, like, oh my gosh, the initial release is 2011. So when I was using it on a project, it must have been fairly new for that split with Hudson.
Right. Cool. Alrighty. Well, the next item up here, again, we talked about it on the Clubhouse, but we'll talk about it here because people who weren't there didn't hear it. But I found this link here called 5 Game Changing iPhone Hacks for 2021 from Mashable. And the reason I posted this was not about all the five tricks, but one in particular, which had to do with it's following up on our talk about using iOS 14.5 and Watch 7 something or other that will allow you to unlock your phone with a face mask on, right? So and on the video, she goes through the steps to enable the unlocking with the watch, which is where the magic happens, right? So presumably it's you who's wearing the watch and you who's holding the phone. I'm not sure if it does do any sort of face tracking at all, like eyeball tracking, but it does go through how Apple's built that workaround. But the other things that it covers off in this article are the location tracking stuff that we were talking about, where, you know, I wasn't sure what, I mean, the ad tracking thing where you can opt in and out of things. And the question is, if you like on my phone, I have allow apps to request to track off, right? And we were debating what that meant. And she answered that this is in fact this means that I'm not being tracked if that's the choice I use, right? A couple of other things that she had in the video that were interesting were fixing your typos. And of course, you know, Mark pointed out that we have talked about this on the show, but I was just too slow to catch it. And that's if you're, you know, when you're trying to struggle with the new way when you select a piece of text and it puts a cursor or a beam on either side and highlights the word. And I always have trouble trying to figure out how to get the cursor to go. And the trick is if you hold the space bar down on the iPhone screen, it turns into a single bar and you can move it around anywhere on the screen without lifting your finger, and you can place the cursor where you want and continue to edit your badly typed tweet and that kind of stuff. So, but Mark pointed out in the Clubhouse that, Tim, we talked about this before.
Think a couple of times.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm now using that trick now that I've learned. And yeah. I've also, by the way, it doesn't work on the iPad with the Magic Keyboard. Magic, you know, the Magic Keyboard, it doesn't work that way. So
no, it does not.
You still have, yeah. But it has a trackpad, so you can put your cursor wherever you want on iPad Pro. Okay.
How are you liking your Magic Trackpad, by the way?
Oh, I use it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that came out of the pandemic purchase that I made, bar none, is this Magic Keyboard. I use it for my WebEx from meetings at work, and I also use it for office tools, right? So I run Teams on here. So if I'm in a meeting, a Teams meeting or a WebEx meeting, I run it off the iPad exclusively. I don't have to worry about VPN or anything like that because the tools all work, you know, with Microsoft authentication or with WebEx authentication without, you know.
The only problem with that is that the camera is on the left or the right edge,
that's
right?
True. Yeah,
so
yeah,
it always looks like you're looking off in the wrong direction when you try to do that.
We don't, I think just because of bandwidth, we don't, and you know, and contention and stuff like that, we don't tend to have meetings with video turned on. We use it for screen sharing, like we share like a document or something, but we generally don't have video on for our conferences.
This is actually something I'm interested in because I've experienced the same thing. So we tend to use it for everything, video for everything, but I've had various meetings with like a group that's at a different site, you know, within my company, and found that they don't use video during their calls, or I've had other calls with people at different companies, and sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It would kind of be an interesting study to see, you know, what the distribution of usage is and this kind of stuff. How about you, Jaime? What do you guys do?
It's kind of weirdly split. So my organization within the company tends to be video on all the time, but when we deal with other organizations within the company, they tend to be audio only. Mm-hmm. And even within our audio on all the time sort of approach, as the months went by in the pandemic, folks started saying, you know what, there is a thing of just getting fatigue from staring at a bunch of postage stamp sized faces always looking at you.
And you're also looking at yourself too, right?
Yeah. And so if you need or just want to go audio only, it's up to you. I tend to go video on all the time unless there's some like really big circumstance, because I kind of like people being able to see me gesturing in the air. I like them to see the look on my face when I make statements so that there's more flavor and nuance. But, you know, I'm very fortunate. I don't have kiddos running around in the background. I don't have, a small apartment where we're like scrunched up with my significant other right behind me, or, you know, think of a million other reasons why people might not want to be on video all the time. And I do think the study of the psychological effects and the organizational ways of handling things will be interesting, because I don't think it will be one size fits all. I'm very critical of the idea of like only going audio only or only going video only. And there's probably some depends on your context sort of answer, I think.
Yep. The other thing too, though, I mean, you're remote all the time, right? Like, are you?
That's right. I've been remote since, well, for this job and the previous job, so since fall of 2016. So coming up on 5 years here, this coming up fall, 4.5 years so far.
Wow. Yeah. So Mark, I think we're sort of debating when we're going back to the office, but I think we're going to be like, there's not much reason for us to be in the office per se, other than, you know, sort of collaboration and stuff like that. But what's your company's sort of view on when do you guys think you get back to the office, or will you ever get back to the office?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. That's still, I think, open for debate. The last official word we had was that no one would be required back until like September or something like that. But that was 6 months ago or so, and things have changed a lot since then. So I don't know. I just don't know the answer. I guess actually September is not that far away. So it's certainly possible that that would be roughly the timeline.
Yeah. So what about vaccines? Have you guys, I mean, I've had my first dose of AstraZeneca, but how about you guys? Have you had any, is it on the horizon for you guys?
Yeah, I had my first shot. I told you about that.
Yeah, I vaguely remember, yeah.
Yep, I had my first one.
I mean, what about you?
We're a bit behind in Washington State, but I just saw on the evening news tonight that April 15th in Washington State, everyone 16 years of age and older will be eligible to get in line. So then the next question is, can I find stuff? Might be okay. I mean, I do work from home, so if it's like, hey, you know, Walgreens has opened up a slot at noon, it's like, great, I'll go right now. Not a problem.
Yeah.
Flex flexibility of not having to deal with other things. So, I mean, everybody's going to need it eventually. It strikes me as puzzling that they just don't do this at like McDonald's drive-thrus, you know, just like drive up, give you a jab, and then give you your sandwich, and there you go.
Well, they're doing it. They're doing it at Canada's Wonderland is like our sort of big sort of Disney place, sort of, you know, like it's like a amusement park. It's got like rides and roller coasters and stuff like that. But they have this huge parking lot, right? And so they're using that as a site for doing getting the jab, right? So, and it's basically in your car. Like, you drive up, roll down your windows, you know, they'll take everybody's health card and make sure that they're legit and give them a jab and away they go, right? So I think you have to make an appointment too, but they have the facility to sort of, you know, create the lanes and all that kind of stuff to move the cars in and out, right? So I went to a pharmacy to get mine done, like in a local pharmacy. Alrighty. And if I could, I would use my Apple Card to pay for that.
Oh, you have to pay for your shot?
No, I'm kidding. I'm giving Harmy a Segway.
He'd get his 2 or possibly 3% if it was part of the extra fancy deals. So this is follow up to way back in apparently, late 2019. If you recall.
Isn't it Steve Stroud and Smith or something like that? Or?
Well, in this case, it was DHH, David Heinemeier Hansen from Basecamp and Ruby on Rails fame, and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak both claim that their women partners or significant others received lower Apple Card credit limits simply for being women. And as it turns out, that's not true, because the New York State Department of Financial Services investigated the banking partner, in this case Goldman Sachs, and said, no, actually everything's perfectly explainable based on other factors, and there is no situation here that would create disparate impacts. There is a bit of like, it's kind of a recommendation, but not a requirement strictly to tell people, like you are required to tell people why you denied them a line of credit. However, you're not required to tell them, you know, what happened to reveal their particular credit limits, right? So if I give you even the most awful credit limit with the worst sort of APR rate on it, if I've given it to you, like I'm under no requirements beyond that, right? And this is actually like a really, really, let me tell you, as somebody who used to work at Simple, this was a huge thing where people would get declined for the debit account and say, hey, actually you're required to do this. Like, well, no, technically no, it's only required for credit per regulation. So the, who are they? The New York State Department of Financial Services investigated, found, you know, some recommendations for like, hey, it would be nicer if Goldman Sachs did these things, but strictly speaking, nothing wrong happened here. So.
Yeah, which is interesting because I could see that with the rank and file, but in the case of Wozniak and DHH, I mean, they're both well-to-do people whose wives presumably are well-to-do as well, right? So kind of wonder, I guess that does raise an eyebrow, right?
That was the thing, but like, you know, what DHH and Wozniak are not talking about is like, so did your significant other never miss a rent payment, possibly for good reasons?
Right.
Did they never, be late on a credit card payment? Like, there's a bazillion different things that credit reports.
And historically, what's the ratio of their income and spending? I think that stuff probably factors in a lot.
Yeah. Because joint and shared accounts is still, again, for those of you who are not within the US of A, our financial technology sector is sort of baffling in terms of how archaic it can be at times. And so I would guess.
The United States? I can't believe that.
Let me tell you, the fancy pants Interact system of Canada completely blows away what we've got on the horizon.
Really?
But that aside, like I would guess, and this is baseless speculation, but I could guess here getting at like what Mark was saying, that even though this couple is like, hey, we share all of our funds, great, but practically speaking, what does that mean? It's like, well, it's not as easy as having like, you know, a family one password account or something. It's like, no. It was probably, for historical reasons, you know, one partner has like the better setup. It's like, oh yeah, cool, I trust you. I'll just log in as you when I use the credit card. I'll log in as you when I move funds around. So as far as the electronic history is concerned, one partner may have absolutely nothing when it comes to credit history for like 10 years, right? However long they've been together. They might have all sorts of other things that you would say, well, logically speaking, this is one, you know, one unit, one family unit. True, it's not the way the financial system looks at things, right? So of whatever, you know, sort of analysis that Goldman Sachs' system is using, would just look at like, hey, so I found this DHH. All right, cool. I see his financial history. Great. Here's his credit limit. Okay. I see, you know, DHH partner. Wow. They've like had no money for 25 years. What's going on here? I guess they will get very small limit, right? Like you could very easily see that situation happening. I don't know that that's the case. Just be really clear. That's speculation is what happened here. But I think we were pretty skeptical of this back when it came out. And it looks like actually nothing was untoward here. Although I have seen some very interesting conspiracy theorists who are like, oh, but like Apple and Goldman Sachs have a bunch of money. They just paid off the regulars. Like, no. That didn't happen. Let me tell you.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. So I saw this next story. I didn't get a chance to dig into it. So why don't you fill us in as I fall down?
Yeah. So the Apple Watch, amongst telling you that it's, you know, time to stand up and do other things, can apparently tell you if you are frail. Mm-hmm. That's the cheeky way of saying that an Apple-funded study, Stanford University, was checking out, you know, can the Apple Watch replace sort of in-clinic, what do they call them? Frailty test, but it's what's NWT stand for? Minute walk test, right? So apparently frailty, and I'm just going to read here from the quote here. Frailty, in this case, is measured in terms of the distance a patient can travel in a six-minute walk. It's normally tested with a six-minute walk test or 6 MWT, and frailty was defined in the study as, quote, walking less than 300 meters on an in-clinic six-minute walk test. And I'm probably going to lean a little bit on Mark here to go over the stats part of this, because it seemed like 60% of the time it works 100% of the time. but they're claiming here, like you're of course going to be better going into the clinic and getting the tests. However, it seems like as a first pass, as nothing else, certainly fine to have the watch do sort of that first filtering of like, seems like you might be frail. Go talk to your doctor.
Hmm. Yeah, I did see that. I saw another graphic, maybe with another link, that kind of showed, I guess, a couple of different metrics that they used to put together to determine your frailty, like your heart rate, your walking speed and that kind of stuff, right? So interesting. And as it says in the article, Tim Cook sees the wearables as the future. Alrighty. What you got next for us? Speaking of Apple and Safari and Siri and whatever.
Yeah. So in the sixth, and wow, they just keep pushing it off, iOS 14.5 beta. Let me tell you, as an aside, I have been waiting for iOS 14.5 and
it's in its sixth beta?
It's apparently, according to this article. So wow. I've been waiting for iOS 14.5 because as folks may or may not remember, I have an Xbox Series X controller that I sure would love to connect to my device, but for not being certified over MFI. MFI made for iPhone? Yeah, MFI made for iPhone. I am just here watching it sit on my desk. And so I've been waiting for the iOS 14.5. I don't have a reason to install the beta. I've been waiting for the release. But in addition to that, apparently Apple will now no longer choose the female sounding voice for Siri by default anymore. So you'll actually be prompted to choose one of the voices, which they do have male voices as well. Hmm. And somebody in the comments says that in French, the default was male for reasons that are unclear to me, possibly cultural, but at least.
Well, I think in the UK, it's English or a male voice as well. I think Greg used to tell us he had the male British voice on his, but I will have to ask our friends on the Slack channel. We have, you know, people from around the world, including Australia and England, to tell us what their default voices are, because they're not the same as the Siri that we get here in Canada or in the US, right? But it's interesting, you know, by the way, that you know how Toronto is the proper pronunciation of Toronto, but no one ever says Toronto. We say Toronto, and Siri says Toronto, which is kind of interesting.
How do you say the number that's one higher than 19?
20?
Okay, yeah, same thing. You don't say the T. 20?
20. Yeah, 20, yeah.
I'm the same. I say 20,
yeah.
But the correct pronunciation, I think, is 20.
Yeah, you want to see us make Tammy go crazy?
Sure.
Ask me to say Java.
What do you say, Java?
I say Java.
Java.
It's not Java. He says Java. I say Java. It's almost like Java, right? Java.
Java.
That's how I've always said it. Java. Right or wrong?
I don't know.
That's follow-up folks as well for this show.
I'm looking at my Siri to see what I had it set on, and it looks like I have it as American female, which is probably the default. But beyond the male choice, I didn't realize.
It tells you something sad about your usage pattern that you didn't even know.
If you'd asked me, I would have sworn, because I do tend to do this for virtual assistants, I tend to switch them to Australian female, because I just find it easier to hear in noisy environments. And maybe since I'm indoors almost all the time now, I haven't noticed that. But I also didn't notice that they had more accents than I recall, and maybe two or three of these are. So in my list, it's American, Australian, British, which I think I saw before, Indian, Irish, and South African.
Yeah, I've got that too.
Don't tickle my memory. So
yeah, South African would be cool. Mine, by for the folks driving at home, is my language is set to English Canada, and my voice is set to American female. So I am using the same voice as you, I guess.
Hmm. Huh. Is there a Canadian female voice?
No, I've just got American, Australian. I've got British, which is probably close. I've got Indian, Irish, and South African. But it'd be interesting to try those other voices just for
fun. There's no French Canadian voice, huh?
No. Well, no. I mean, if my language was French, I'm sure that would change, right?
No.
Like if I choose.
Actually, that's an interesting question. Do they have a different for French? Do they have a different accent for Canadian, French Canadian, and Parisian Canadian?
There is a difference in the French for sure, like between those two countries.
Right. But does Siri have a difference? That's the question.
Yeah. Well, I would think so, because like I've got English Canada. English Canada is different than English UK or English American, right? Mm-hmm. I used to use US for everything. Like I use a US keyboard on my Mac setup as well, just because I found, you know, with back in the early days, applications wouldn't behave properly if I didn't have the American wasn't using a US keyboard. So I've tended to use US all the time, and it's only been lately, and I guess probably last 4 or 5 OSs, that I've given up fighting and just put in Canadian, right? Because it used to be like, so here's an annoying thing, and this goes back to like, I can't remember if it was classic or, yeah, it probably was classic or early iOS, early Mac OS, but when you set up your Mac, it would ask if you wanted to use Canada as your region, right? And if you did that, it would start accepting French spellings, and it would start doing all this weird, you know, dictionary stuff that didn't make sense to me, right? I'd rather get yelled at for the way I spell color than have to deal with the sort of weirdness that was coming that way, right? So I used to always set up every single OS, every single Mac I ever set up with, I would choose a US keyboard and US English, right? So, but it's only been in the last, I guess they must have fixed a bunch of bugs in it over the years, but weird, eh? And of course, you know, the keyboard layout's different in French too, like the size of the return key is different, and of course they've got extra accent keys that they use. So the French keyboard layout is different than the English keyboard that we use in English-speaking Canada.
Right? Yeah, let me tell you, when I saw the British keyboard over there in the UK, it completely destroyed my mind. It was something I could not type on because I was hitting the wrong keys, because the shape of the return key or enter key is wildly different.
Yeah, it's vertical as opposed to horizontal, right?
Yeah. It's like that Tetris L shape when you rotate it.
Yeah.
So the heavy part's on top. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hangovers from typewriter days. Alrighty. So what are we doing about the iPhone, the small iPhone, Jaime?
Very sad things here, because according to this blog post by Law Jimenez, nobody designs for small iPhone devices anymore. And this is the best quote right here at the top. Quote, nobody designs for small iPhone devices anymore. Why do I say this? Well, if you've been rocking the iPhone SE 2020, you would know. What I'm saying is there are a lot of UI glitches from apps running on iPhone SE, and he gives pretty good examples of Clubhouse's app, you know, not measuring the width properly, so you can see some of the other view controller. Spotify, apparently it is impossible to refresh the little table view there unless you drag up with your left thumb to get the refresh button to appear and then tap it with your right. And it's not just third-party apps, which there's a whole bunch of here. Again, we'll have this link in the show notes for those of you driving home, but there are some Apple ones too, like Apple Shortcuts. You can't enter the folder name because you can't see it. Or Apple TV, where, wow, that's a very huge header space. There's probably 33% of the screen top that's just used for the black header area that has, you know, the Apple logo, TV Plus, and then you can finally see the first large hero image, which in this case is for the Servant TV series.
I was going to say, I could see that on small teams. Like, I know the Clubhouse app was written by a guy, right? And you know, it's still in beta and it's written by one person, but like larger teams, you know, with proper QA, our QA people test, you know, all the layouts from all the devices, right? So I could understand if it's like a single developer shop or small team where they're doing their own QA, they might miss it, but it's a lot of work, but to sort of cater to them. But yeah, there are still, you know, the SE and the 5S and that kind of stuff are still around, right? So two SEs right now.
I have to say I'm not surprised at all. I can recall working with a designer a few years back. I'm thinking of one particular where I was pretty strongly recommending that they design for the small phone and then it's easier to expand it. And this designer was adamant that, no, we must design for the big screen and then scale it down.
Really?
I don't know why. So that's what they did. And they were very shocked when things just didn't fit anymore on the small screen. I don't get it. But, you know, sometimes designers don't listen to developers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen that in my career as well, where you kind of feel like, you know, I think I've joked once of like telling the head of designs, like, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask your design folks, like, hey, do you have iCloud backup? You do? Good. Great. And just break their phone and be like, here you go. Now here's this iPhone SE that you have to use so that you aren't just like, oh, you know, you pick up a testing device, you look at it, you know, make a few tweaks. No, I want you to live that experience so you understand the pain, because I think folks don't get it. Because I also heard similar things that Marcus heard of, like, oh, we design for the big one and then we scale it down. Like, we don't have, you know, like, size classes are not magic, right? We can't just make something that says, like, hey, when this phone gets, you know, ridiculously smaller, you know, compared to what is the norm, we can't just flip to a completely different layout. And even if we could, that'd be very expensive to do versus just having a more flexible layout that's designed for the smaller screen. And then we can give things a little bit more breathing room where there is more space, right? And something like a Max or even just, you know, the Pro models. Apparently, I mean, this is very prevalent throughout the industry. Google's on here. We said Spotify already. Who else is on here? Apple, Medium, Pinterest. Way down here, he says, like, I'm just going to stop on this blog post, but like, you get my point now of all the various areas in which people are forgetting, you know, that as these newer, and the iPhone SE 2020 is actually a little bit larger, right? It's not the iPhone 5 style anymore. It's like an iPhone 6, isn't it?
I think so.
It's even more egregious to not have support for that size of a phone.
Can we move on to the big announcement? This, as we record yesterday, it was a big surprise announcement on a Tuesday from Apple. Surprise, surprise. WWDC is coming to a screen near you. So we got the new graphic, sort of playing off of the supply with Hair Supply, or the video last year was Hair Supply opening up the M1 at the big announcement last year. What do you guys think? It's going to be all virtual again this year, and it's back to the first week of June, which is, I think last year was unusual because it was a little later, right?
We're not surprised that it's happening, right? And I don't think anyone's surprised that it's virtual. So at this point, it's sort of, it's cool, but it's not a huge story, right?
Yeah, no, but, yeah, I think what I was getting at was last year, the date was delayed by a couple of weeks because of, mm-hmm. you know, because Apple had to sort of, you know, regroup and figure out what they were doing, right? So, and then they did that amazing sort of Netflix drop every day of you know, content. I assume they're going to do the same thing this year as well, right?
I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, which would be cool. What do you think? Last year I was telling Leo on the previous show that we did watch parties last year where we got together. We looked at what the daily drop of topics were. And as a group, we decided what we would watch together, and we would simultaneously hit play and, you know, comment in the Slack channel as we watched together, you know, with four or five people from around the globe. Some people in California, some people in Berlin on one single call. So what do you think? I mean, like, you know, we've talked about the M1s, you know, the first kick at the Apple Silicon Max. I mean, I'm holding out for an Apple 16, or not a 16, but I'm holding out for another iteration of 13, right? So what do you guys think?
Yeah.
Well, I think almost definitely there'll be a 16. I'd be shocked if there wasn't. I think the past year has been, you know, a trial run in some sense for the M1, and I think it succeeded beyond everyone's expectations. So yeah, I'd be shocked if there wasn't a next generation of hardware, and the 16 is the obvious one.
Yeah. Well, you're the only one of us that's reusing an M1 right now. What do you think about after having it for like 3-4 weeks now, right?
Yeah. I mean, the honest truth is that I don't notice that much difference. It's faster than my old machine. Yes. Is it life-changingly faster? No, it's not. But it's faster. And, you know, I was running on a 2013 machine, running Mojave actually. So yeah.
So anything's going to be an improvement, right?
Everything's an improvement. But I have no complaints, except, well, sometimes I see beach balls maybe a little more than I would hope. But it's perfectly fine. And I understand that that's not very enthusiastic, but, you know, that's what it is. It's perfectly fine. It's a good next generation machine, which is kind of what you want, right? I mean, it dropped into their line of hardware rollouts as the next generation one would, and with no glitches, and it was cheaper. So yeah, that's definitely a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did it blow me away in terms of speed? No, I can't say it did.
Right.
I feel like the alternative take to that, right? Because, and I think it's a really useful one, because we've definitely gotten a lot of praise out in the media about, like, you know, stuff being faster, and your mileage or kilometerage may vary on that. Mm-hmm. But I think the sort of hidden thing is that, for what I hear you saying, Mark, is that it wasn't like a dumpster fire. You're not like, oh man, like this transition sucked. It was like, oh, it's right. Actually
exactly
pretty smooth and painless, which is about
and
as
that's
best
exactly
you can
what
hope
you want.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Yeah. Have it be a non-issue switching from Intel to Apple Silicon.
Yeah. Didn't mean to make it sound, I might have made it sound a little bit more negative than I meant to there.
But, well, you haven't found any particular apps that made you take pause and say that doesn't work or that's a challenge for me.
Now, actually, there have been some issues with some command line development stuff that I've had to do. There have been some things about, well, that's not really so much because of the M1. It's because of the need to do multi-platform, multiple architectures, you know, building for x86 and for M1 at the same time.
How are you getting around that?
Well,
because I've heard issues with that the slices aren't available for Intel on the M1s. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, you have to compile yes. I mean, it does kind of come down to that, is that it's, I haven't been able in this particular case to figure out how to get one particular thing to compile on the x86 as a dynamic library that I could link to my x86 build on in Xcode. So I'm building an external dynamic library in a different language, not in Swift or anything, you know, and I want to use that as part of a Mac app build. And on my old x86 machine, it worked fine. I just build it for x86 natively. I would link it to the x86 build in Xcode natively, and it worked fine. On the M1, after a little bit of, you know, a day or so of having to mess around and figure things, I was able to build the dynamic library natively on M1 and then link it to an M1 Mac app. Great. But then the next step is, well, I don't want to have to, you know, go run this on another machine. So what I want to do is be able to have on the M1 build both an x86 version and an ARM version, and then have targets in Xcode for both, and then just have it all kind of work as one universal app, which you're supposed to be able to do, but it just doesn't seem to work. I think I can build the x86 version just using client command line, but when I try to link it to my Mac app, it just won't link to the x86 version. So I have had to resort to building one version on the M1 and one version on an x86 machine,
need to run Jenkins on your old Mac.
This is really upset of that one.
Yeah.
So
well, but the old Mac can't build for M1.
No, I know, but we found the same issue with recently with some tests that we were doing. We were finding that we were doing a real quick test and we found that we couldn't build to the simulator for some reason. So we ended up building to a device so that we could actually, because then the ARM slices are there, right? So yeah, I think it was the opposite problem you were having, right? Which we found really, really puzzled us. It was third party dependencies. Cursed third party dependencies.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole different story. In this case, I was building the third party dependency myself.
Right.
In your case, if the third party vendor hasn't provided a version that has an M1 slice, then you're out of luck.
Right. Right.
And nothing you can do.
Yeah. I think that was the issue for us.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, well, we're hoping. Well, I guess that's the thing. You know, we kind of hope that, I mean, like last year we got, you know, native Swift UI apps, right? The year before we got Swift UI. What kind of surprise and delight are we going to get from Xcode tooling and framework tooling this year? Do you think they're going to take Catalyst to another level, or Swift UI to an even further level? What do you think that's going?
Well, for sure, there'll be incremental changes to SwiftUI. It's, you know, we're in year three of it now. So it's getting to be at the point where there's not going to be as many just like groundbreaking, you know, life-changing things happening with SwiftUI. Although I'd say we're not quite there yet where it's, you know, it's something people are using. For the most part, people aren't using this every day for production, I don't think. Some people are, I guess, but I think a lot of people aren't. You know, we're getting to the point where there'll be certainly like polishing the, you know, sanding the edges and things like that and polishing, and things will just work a little bit better, work a little bit more smoothly. Probably see more things that were UIKit under the hood become not UIKit under the hood in SwiftUI.
Mm-hmm. I think that'll apply to AppKit as well.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I think I was going to talk about the Mac stuff in when I talk about my pick, because as you know, I played around with doing a Mac app the other day and following it, Ray Wunderlich book. And I was amazed at some of the stuff that you can do in SwiftUI, like fairly simply, like, you know, with app storage, which uses the user defaults kind of stuff to save, and it's like an app storage wrapper, like an environment variable kind of property wrapper kind of thing, and it just kind of you know, you give it a key and presto changer, it writes it to the user defaults, and you can read back from it using the same thing, which is kind of cool. And how you can very easily you've got a SwiftUI command to build either a brand new Apple menu or a brand like a menu like for the Mac app, or you can actually add to an existing menu. There's a couple of processes or modifiers inside of SwiftUI, and also the ability to write preferences, you know, because obviously preferences are the sort of big thing on them. You know, we have settings bundles on iOS. Those become preferences on when you convert to a Mac app and how to deal with those, right, sort of thing, right? So that was kind of cool to see that in SwiftUI, and I would think that kind of modifiers will go further into helping us out. I wonder if, you know, more development on Combine since seems to be growing in its capabilities as well, right? You know?
Yeah, I think quality of life stuff, right? So certainly would like to see the tooling get better and smarter with suggesting things for you and helping you diagnose problems with SwiftUI, Swift itself for that nature, right? Seeing, you know, more and better, like, hey, this is the thing you did wrong, not, you know, some nonsense. You're like, what is that? Oh, what you mean is I'm missing a slash here. Okay, cool. Let me do that then, right? Like this, getting it as weird as it seems, but getting it back to how really good that stuff was in telling you what you did wrong in Objective-C. Quite literally many moons ago, right? This is definitely a many moons ago sort of thing. So I think that'll be good because you get more, agility out of just having the tooling just speed you along and not be like, I don't know what that is. Let me go look on Stack Overflow, right?
Yeah. And if there's one thing that they could do in Xcode that I would love more than anything else is improve the way they allow you to trace code through protocols. Mm-hmm. So you very commonly, if you do a lot of protocol oriented stuff, you very commonly have a situation where you have code that's referencing some protocol that could be a concrete object, is a concrete object somewhere when it actually comes in. But when you're tracing the code, it's not runtime. You can't just probe it. You know, I mean, you could do that, but if you're just like trying to look at the code and you want to know where this thing comes from, something, right? But when it's referenced by a protocol, you don't know necessarily what the concrete class or struct that's conforming to that protocol is when it's being used at the time that you're seeing it in your code. And Xcode just kind of gives up at that point. You know, you if you try to trace down into the protocol, it shows you the protocol definition, but it doesn't show you any of the concrete objects that are conforming. So I guess I'd like to see a way, like with a right click or something like that. If I right click on a protocol, I want to see a list of every class that conforms to that protocol in my code base. How about that? that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, because this gets doubly worse when, you know, people get kind of cute and generic with the names. And I know naming is difficult, but heaven help me when it's like, oh, good, this thing is called Vue. I don't know how I'm going to find that. That's an unsearchable thing. It's like if it was super happy fun time Vue, so SHF Vue, like, oh, trivial, easy to find in the code base. but just view. I'm like, oh no, I'll never be able to find it. I hope it's in a logical place, because now I'm digging through the folder hierarchy like an animal, right? Versus what you described, Mark, of like, just show me everywhere where this is. You know, do the analysis of my project. You know what could happen at runtime. Show me what it is. Yeah. Even if you're just guessing and you're wrong a little bit of the time, that's okay. Yeah. At least you've helped me narrow down, you know, where exactly within a foot or two of this haystack is this dang needle.
Exactly. Prove to me that you're doing something useful every time you say indexing and I get a beach ball spinning for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm just looking at my Xcode here. Like, you mean underneath this? I don't know what you call that. What is that thing called? And hover. Oh, the navigate to related items thing menu. You know that one where you can look up your callers and stuff like that?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It does list superclasses, extensions, protocols, categories, siblings, subclasses. And it doesn't really, like, it doesn't sort of do what you said, Mark. Like, I can see what protocol I've adopted here, but unfortunately, it's one from UIKit, so it's kind of straightforward. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And making that pervasive, because, Mark, I'm guessing you were talking about it from like a, you know, looking at lines of text, but you might as well also follow the same thing of like, all right, I've had to go into the view debugger. Now show me where the heck this thing is coming from. What is it that's causing this problem? That'd be really nice.
Yeah. More information, some better instance information on the view debugger would be kind of nice. Yeah.
Right. Well, Apple is a hardware company. What do you think? What do you crystal ball as far as what we'll see in, of course, been all those false rumors that we've been, you know, led down the garden path with recently, but what do you think will happen with hardware this year?
16-inch MacBook Pro,
the 16-gig Apple Car. What do you think?
Watch a car? No, there's not going to be a car this year. There might be a new version of the Mini HomePod.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, think they'll add the, what is it, the spatial awareness? What is that thing called that's in the old HomePod? The OG spatial? You know what I mean? Like where it automatically adjusts to the room?
Yeah, maybe. Right. They've got the technology from the original one. Can't imagine that it adds that
U1 chip
cost.
Or something like that. I think
maybe
it
needs a new chip. Yeah.
Yeah. It had the U1 chip, I think, in the HomePods. But because that's the one thing that's missing from the minis is they don't really interface with the. Do they interface with the 4K? And I hooked mine up to my to watch the Justice League last week. I hooked the HomePod I got to my TV and my Apple TV 4K, and it sounds amazing. Huh. But yeah, I wonder where the mini's going.
I do think a new replacement for their iMacs, since it seemed like, or is it iMac
Pro?
Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe they stopped, seemed to have discontinued there. I'm like, kind of makes sense that, you know, you'd have Apple Silicon-based iMacs that can take on the needs of what that iMac Pro sort of top end was needing. And it may or may not happen this year, but relatively soon, Apple Silicon-based Mac Pros for the ultra high end.
Mm-hmm. Does the iMac doesn't currently have a 5K screen, right? Because that's what the iMac Pro had.
But the iMacs did, but maybe it is.
The newer iMacs. Head over to Apple and have a look.
I mean, the invitation that went out to folks has the couple things. It has the internet meme of Greg Federighi opening up the laptop for the Apple Silicon, I think, from last year. And people have gotten really excited, like, oh, this character is wearing glasses. And although you could say, well, their glasses are just, you know, reflecting what's on the screen, it has also made the criminologist say, but I wonder if that's AR-related stuff that they're hinting at, that, you know, AR glasses might be coming out.
Possible. For sure they're going to do something interesting with AR, because they've been making lots of investment there.
Mm-hmm. By the way, just to break in, Retina 4K display on the 27-inch iMac currently shipping. You're right, there is a 4K version of the iMac, but it's not 5K. I want 5K. There's a lot of speculation about that, the glasses. But a former co-host of our show said, I wouldn't read too much into those graphics, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they never mean anything, right? So.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, it's a play, like Jaime said, it's a play on the Craig Federighi thing. I mean, people were looking at the Mac and speculating on, you know, the fact that they don't see a track bar on the Mac. They don't see, you know, what can you really see other than a few keys, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
You think we'll see the tile thing this year?
The tracking tile. Great. You mean, I sure hope so, because it's getting a little silly that it has been rumored and almost solidly confirmed from people picking apart the betas, right? It's not like, oh, random person said. It's like, no, we found graphics that go towards this, that you'd like to see it ship and not be like the Air Power? Is that the name of the charging man?
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, maybe it needs an Air Power to charge it, so they couldn't ship it.
air powered charging. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to speculate on what really is going to come from Apple. I mean,
it is
like the rumor. Like, I mean, I don't know. Did the rumors even make sense last year? Right. Like we had that one lady that we followed last year who had a whole bunch of prognostications and she was pretty good. You know, I got to say though, I've been playing around with SwiftUI and following some newer tutorials these days. And finding that Xcode has really gotten good at helping, you know, like you said, you know, if you're doing code completion, that kind of stuff, the fix seemed to point out, you know, much clearer what your problem is, you know, kind of thing. Like, you know, if you call something, should it be, you know, if you create an instance, should it be an optional or not or whatever, right? So, or if you don't close a computer variable properly with, you know, the little parentheses at the end there, it kind of gives you a strange warning, but it makes sense, you know? And I'm finding that I was watching, I'm going to talk about video later on in my picks, where the guy was showing, if you watch the way he types out his code, he's figured out a shorthand to sort of get the code completion to help, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like if you're working on if you adopt a protocol, for instance, in something and you wait a second, the compiler will say this doesn't conform to the protocol and you just wait and you do run the fix it, it'll stub in the methods you need, right? And then you can very quickly go through and not miss something that is required, which is kind of cool. And I think too, yeah, like if he was building like a CG rect or something, or he was working with min X or min Y, instead of starting to type min or max, he would type Y or X, and the code completion would help by saying, okay, well, you need a min or a max here, right? And it would automatically pop that in for him as soon as he hit return on the keyboard, right? So it's kind of a shorthand way of getting Xcode to help you, right? Like if you're doing a table view, you can start writing cell for row at index, and it'll put in the whole method with the override and everything as required, right? Have you found that when you're working with Xcode?
I feel like I've adjusted some. Like I still, you know, even though the good old, if you recall, for NS string finally being like, okay, people mostly were typing NS string and not NS stream. I think I've done enough of the, okay, I'm just going to trick the autocomplete into doing what I want without naturally typing the way I would type is what I think I'm doing. So I don't know. I'd have to sit and really like try not to give it hints and just say, you figure out what I'm most likely to be writing here and help me out. I don't know that I've done that for a while. Maybe I've just hard coded all of the little patterns. Like, all right, type 33 characters. I know it's going to get me what I want, sort of thing.
Right.
Versus,
yeah,
just
that's what I'm saying,
naturally,
right? Yeah.
Typing what I should be typing if I was going sort of left to right on everything.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. But I find that the Xcode sort of the code hinting has been much better. Like if you create a variable and then on the next line, let's say you create a variable called library, right? And then on the next line, you want to set some properties for that. If as soon as you hit the letter L, it'll pop in a suggestion for the word library, right? Like for the name, your variable name, and you can carry on with having it automatically pick out the things that you could apply to that particular variable, right? Whereas opposed in the past, it was like anybody's guess what you would get, right? But I'm just finding that lately Xcode's been a lot more helpful in that sense, right?
Right, but it's still not as good as it was when in the Objective-C days.
Oh, that's true, and don't try and refactor any Objective-C these days. Have you noticed that?
Like, is that broken?
No. Yeah, well, it doesn't seem to be. Yeah, I think it's more. Yeah, this could just be me, but yeah, I'm finding that, you know, with Objective-C, it's not as helpful as it used to be.
Mm.
Yeah, like the refactor commands and rename commands don't seem to work in Objective-C as well as they used to. Right? Any other wish list things for WWDC that you were looking forward to?
I think this would not have been on my list, but given what we talked about just before this topic, more size classes related stuff might be kind of in the cards, I would hope.
I've given up even asking for that.
So if we're not going to get help for the small devices, I'd like to see, and I feel like maybe I need to stop giving up on this one too. I'd like to see something, like a cloud functions or similar related to CloudKit. And yes, I know folks are going to say, hey, but like, remember when they did that session last year with Amazon's AWS Lambda? I'm like, that's true. That's good. But if you're going all in on the idea of, you know, protecting people's privacy and going as Apple only as possible, and if you want to make those HomePod minis, more effective with more skills and more fun things, I really do think that having some sort of executable function thing that you could run through Apple's iCloud would be great. You know, just take what CloudKit has been doing and doing well and take it to that next level. Yeah, I'd like to see more of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see more emojis.
Oh, I guarantee you're going to see those. That'll be the little carrot on the stick to try to get people to upgrade to, what are we on, iOS 15, 15.1.
15, yeah.
Yeah. And let's get rid of all the designers and just use SF symbols from now on, right? What do you think?
It's going to use all those vector graphics.
Yeah.
We can put it as a small little 44-point touch area, or we can put it as a billboard. It works just as well.
Yeah. So what do you think the watch can do, right? Like last year, a couple of years ago, we got the EKG. You know, do you think we're going to get blood pressure and sugar levels maybe?
Well, we got blood ox, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, blood ox. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Blood oxygen. Yeah. I guess you have to have a newer phone for that. Watch, I mean.
How would it do blood pressure? Because it would need to like inflate or something like that, right?
True. Maybe the watch band will like
bang. Inflatable watch band? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know about that one.
What about sugar levels? I guess not, right?
How would it do that? Just from, can they do that by like some kind of optical?
I don't know how the ones that people wear on their abdomens or arms or whatever, they have like, I think it has like, I don't know if it has like a pin or whatever that it measures the,
yeah,
and it sends it by Bluetooth to the device.
I can't imagine Apple doing something invasive like that. That's a very specialized thing. Mm. And it would take years and years and years of FDA approvals to make that.
So what could they possibly do on the watch that would make it leap off the page? Like the blood ox and the cycle measurement and cycle tracking that they added in the last couple of years.
I'm trying to think of how things work. Like the big trouble for me is I'm just very ignorant of how some of these things can work. Like if you'd ask me, oh, we can check blood oxygen, like how does it do that without actually observing oxygen? It's like, oh, you mean you can just flash little lights at it and look at the pretty pictures? Like, oh, okay, cool. I mean, can you do that with blood sugars? Can you do that with electrolytes or other things? Like what can you actually get from, you know, tiny little camera checking things? That blood pressure, I'm like desperately trying to remember. It's like I know volume is related to temperature. Like, could you do something like that? Could they have a temperature sensor and then see like rate of change of flow? I was like, I don't know. I was desperately trying to get to like fluid dynamic type stuff and could not remember.
Hmm. You have the Ollie always on screen mark on your watch?
I almost never wear my watch.
But you have the always on screen thing, right? Didn't you get a new watch recently?
A couple of years ago.
Okay. I thought you were talking about the always on, the feature. Was that last year they added that or 2 years ago? Last year they added the SE, which is the smaller watch for the youngins, right?
Right. Maybe it was 2 years ago that they did it. And then, so that probably would be the model I have then. I don't know. Like I said, I rarely wear it. Mm. I think that's the problem. How many Apple Watches do you see around these days? Do you see a lot?
Well, I mean, I wear mine every day, but
yeah.
You see that, but I do think that there's the passive health thing to it. And so I'm struggling to think of what things might you do. I don't know, maybe this frailty test thing will just be going on in the background. It might just sense like, hey, we notice you seem to be not doing so well on that, was it 6-minute walk test, right? So you're out there walking the dog. It's like, hey, so were you walking the dog and they stop and pee a lot? Or were you kind of struggling to make that pace? I mean, I could see more of the doing the analysis, right? We've seen it recognizes how to track your activity for various kinds of activity like swimming and other sort of non-traditional things. So I could see more of those. I'm kind of wondering if there's going to be a, it detects COVID or something, right? Like is there going to be a big marquee one? I don't know that there will be.
Or maybe they'll finally, put some extra motion sensors in there so it can work with Fitness Plus and be like a Wii joystick, that kind of thing.
Well, they did have that last year. It was able to do dance movements and stuff like that, right? So somehow it's able to check your motion that way as well.
Yeah. Right? So this is the path we should go down for this. I think services seems to be the thing. So last year they introduced Fitness Plus, they introduced Arcade, TV Plus was a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah. Arcade was a couple of years ago too.
Okay.
Well, they added Apple One last year, right? They came up
with that. Which was just a consolidation of things. So we may think that last year they had to not announce a bunch of things because of the pandemic, because stuff just wasn't done in time. And maybe we'll see lots of extra stuff that they normally would have released last year, maybe. Mm. So what would that be then? What could be new and big? I mean, we've got TV Plus. I don't know what they could do there, unless maybe some kind of more interactive TV. I don't know.
Well, what about the games, Mark? Because you were going down the route of what if your watch had more sensors that made it a little bit more akin to like the very, much years old, like Nintendo Wii sort of remote. And now I've made it so like, hey, then you could sell two Apple Watches because everybody could have one on each wrist and you can do the boxing sort of game for the Nintendo Wii. All you need is two watches.
Or a ring or something like that too, right? You could have like an Apple ring that would work with your watch.
There was a startup that was doing that years back. back. They made a ring that had like some biosensors in there for fitness stuff.
The Oura ring. Yeah, a few friends of mine have that one.
There was a different one. Maybe, I guess there was more than one. But I mean, did they ever take off really? I mean, you don't really hear too much about those, right?
The one guy I know who has the Oura ring also has the coffee cup that's controlled by his phone, so he can make sure it's coffee's always at the right temperature. Because those are important things, right?
Right, right. So yes, there will always be some people who buy everything. Yes.
Especially if it's shiny and has an apple on it. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right, what about TV then? Let's look up TV. What could they possibly do with TV? I mean, I don't mean the services, because obviously they're still doing that stuff, like the shows and stuff. Aren't they up for some Academy Awards and stuff like that this year?
Probably Emmys, are, right? Not Academy Awards, right?
But they haven't. Was it Emmys that got nominated?
Emmys are TV.
Well, they won a Golden Globe for that Jason Sudeikis soccer one.
Right, Ted Lasso as a TV show.
Yeah, that was a TV show. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. No, I meant the actual hardware. Like, what do you think about the hardware? Do you think they'll increment that somehow? Or
they did retire some models this year, right? So maybe it probably is due for a hardware update, just a speed update or things like that. I don't know. They in terms of new features, they haven't done much in a couple of years, right? They haven't really done too much with it.
The TV, you know. Yeah. Well, as soon as they added 4K, I mean, what could they do? I mean, that wouldn't be worthy of being on the stage at WWDC if they're just going to, you know, increase the memory or put a faster chip in it or something, right?
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, making it, you know, perform just as well, but be, you know, a small streaming stick that's cheap could be a pretty good one. Like, I think it's less necessary given their willingness to be installed on, you know, and smart TVs and et cetera, and to open things up. Like I have AirPlay 2 capability on my Roku. But, you know, there's still something to be said for controlling that entire brand. And honestly, they probably should, along the same vein, since they, you know, they're sticking around in the home category with the HomePod minis, kind of feel like they need to come up with something that is a wireless router, right? They got out of it for reasons that are a little unclear, but I think they could do better than, you know, some of the nuttiness we've seen related to routers and just having it be like the central piece of your home.
You thinking like a HomeKit hub kind of thing, or?
Yeah. So it's like, all right, cool. So connect it to your Ethernet. Great. It gives you Wi-Fi connectivity. It's now your known home base for running, you know, even separated networks for just your HomeKit stuff. So nefarious hackers are unable to, you know, turn on your toaster oven and kill you in the middle of the night sort of thing. Mm. Right. And it's like, oh, well, you know, we've got like a video platform. Great. Everything's kept here locally. This thing even has storage on it. Like, you could just do a very Apple-like thing for this piece that, like, you can't go top to bottom Apple. At some point, you're going to have an Eero, or you're going to have Netgear or Linksys or some other, you know, non-Apple device that's just sitting there gleefully sniffing the traffic on everything that your very locked down Apple device is doing as you're cruising the interwebs.
Yeah, but you know, the whole Wi-Fi device comes back to, I mean, like, I think I was I think it was Macworld actually, where they introduced the time capsule, right? And the sort of Apple base station. So that's kind of an old technology. I don't know if Apple needs to be in that game, right?
Yeah. I mean, unless they did some kind of a mesh internet thing.
But I mean, why would they? I mean, like look who they're competing with. There's some, you know, Google has one, Eero has one, you know, Netgear has one, you know, there's tons of them out there. Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see what they got cooking up for us. I think we're in for some surprises this year, I think, right?
Could be.
All right. Well, let's move on to our picks. I got a lot of picks, so I'm going to let Hyman go first. What do you got for us, Hyman?
Yeah, mine is free4.dev. That is free-for.dev. And it's a big collection of the kinds of things you might be able to get for free as, you know, more and more folks are trying to do, you know, indie type of development, at least as a side gig. Or the 5 to 9, as the commercial says, using Dolly Parton's song in verse. You know, so it's got a listing here of your analytics providers, cloud providers, you know, what they might have for free limits, monitoring, email, just, you know, code editors and et cetera. This big list of things that you say, wow, I really do need, you know, some sort of database as a service. It's like, well, okay, cool. Well, you got FaunaDB and Airtable and Influx. And he's like, okay, cool. I'm great. But man, I'm like creating so many logs. Cool. Well, you know, there's LogDNA and Loggly, you know, Sumo Logic. You know, they have some varying degrees of free stuff. So just a big collection here. I think it's a GitHub page, right? So yeah, you can even submit your own pull request if there's something on there. You're like, oh, wow, it's great and free. Sure would love to add something. You can. Pull requests presumably accepted. You know, be nice to them.
Hmm. Well, speaking of tomorrow, as we record, it's March 31st. Tomorrow is the day that Apple changes the push notification style using tokens, right? Mm-hmm. And so Microsoft Azure has free notification hubs. I wonder if they're really free. Learn more about hub pricing. No upfront costs, no termination fees, pay only what you need. Still doesn't say what it costs. Oh, up to a million pushes per tier for free. Cool. So there's a lot of things to look at on this table here, right?
Yeah, so a million pushes per subscription per tier. I don't know what this active devices per namespace is, which is 500. I guess for those 500 people, just divide up the million pushes as you completely pummel them with your, hey, there's new content sort of stuff. But, you know, it's good stuff to get you started, right? And wait until you scale enough to be interesting for them to care about pricing. Like, well, by that point, you've hopefully hit some sort of, you know, market fit where having a little bit of coins coming out of your pocket each month is worth it. As now you've got a fledgling business there.
Yeah, lots of stuff. This goes on for days, this page. Nice, right? So I have a related one, and we talked about it in the clubhouse, but I'll talk about it here today. This one's called xcodetips.github.io. Not sure who started it, but remember we talked about those 25 or so tips that Paul Hudson published before Christmas, right? You know, all really fabulous things. So this is Xcode Tips in a sort of GitHub format, so that, you know, as time passes, we'll have more things grow here as well, right? So some of those tips that Paul Hudson was talking about published here, like, you know, creating commands / to create GitHub or Xcode documentation comments, you know, jump to the navigator with Command Shift J, which is one of my favorite commands, you know, remapping keyboard commands, increasing font size and editor size, generating interface command control up arrow to do that for your Swift files. Anyway, so this is is being maintained, and as things grow, we'll see more and more things added to it. So that's the xcode-tips.github.io page. I have a link in the show notes for that.
Yeah, I'm adding a new quality of life thing that I'd like to see. I'd like to see actual bookmarks and not have to abuse breakpoints as bookmarks, because when I do actually need to do some debugging, those bookmarks start cluttering up my screen.
Oh, yeah. Cool. I mentioned this last, maybe two episodes ago, that Apple had updated the iOS dev tutorials, but they've added a, and I've gone through these, one of them was introduced last year when they came out with Swift UI, 2 years ago, I guess, but they've added a UI kit one here, which is kind of nice. It sort of walks through, if you're curious about writing a UI kit app, the flow for the one tutorial on Swift UI actually takes you down the path of creating a Swift UI app natively, and then also shows you how to build a watch app and a Mac app from the same build. So using the same code, you can build across platforms. So that's a really nice thing. And that's been updated again just last week, I think, right? And they added that UI kit one. We've been doing a lot of training at work because, you know, obviously people are stuck from home and we can't really have people come in. Like, I work in a large corporation, and sometimes we have, you know, people come up and do like in-class sessions with our developers where we take a day or two and learn some advanced, you know, Swift or something like that. Well, we've not been able to do that this year. So they stood up a training portal for us to do, you know, LinkedIn kind of learning and Pluralsight stuff. But one of the interesting things that one of my colleagues pointed out is not part of that program, but this is a piece on lynda.com, which is connected to LinkedIn right now. I think they've LinkedIn bought lynda.com. It's called Swift 5 Protocol Oriented Programming. So in keeping with what Mark was talking about earlier, if you want to learn a bit more about protocol-oriented programming, take a look at this tutorial here. The instructor is a guy named Corelli Nyastor. Really good teaching style. I mean, I've watched a number of his things recently on Pluralsight, and he was, I guess, previously on LinkedIn, or I'm not sure if he's publishing to whoever will take his work, but he's got a really good teaching style, very comprehensive explanation about things. Personally, I'm going through a couple of code patterns that he's another couple of tutorials he's put together. But yeah, I really enjoyed this protocol oriented programming one. Talked about it at the Clubhouse last week as well too. But yeah, definitely check that one out. I'll have a link in the show notes for that one. And I also stumbled across another instructor, which I really like his style. And I think he's just started out too, which is kind of cool. I was Googling around and I saw a Medium article. I'm not sure if I saw it on Twitter or something, on using Swift's custom string convertible. And as he explains in the video, StudApps is the name of the the YouTube page. I don't know the name of the writer. I guess I could look at his Stephen Curtis, I think is his name. Yeah, because he's writing on, he's got an article here on Medium. And so it was kind of funny because I found the article on Medium, and at the top of the thing it said, hey, there's a YouTube video here. So I just put it on and watched it, and it's really good. I learned better from videos than I do from reading. But this is the guy I was telling you about. If you watched, like I watched this one, Swift, this custom string convertible, I really recommend that you take a look at that. It really explains the protocol really well. But he's also got another tutorial on using Charles backend, like mocking a Charles backend, like using Charles proxy. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that tool, but he's got this little tutorial on building an app and mocking the whole backend using Charles, you know, because you can do a rewrite and he creates this fake, you know, mybackend.com URL and goes in and populates that. But what's really cool about his tutorial style is if you watch him type in Xcode, he doesn't talk about it, but this is the guy I was telling you that, you know, he has these sort of, he looks like he's figured out a bunch of shorthands to get Xcode to bend to your will. Like to, you know, when you're typing out a CG rect or whatever, and you need to put an X and a Y size and min max, whatever, he's figured out how to, like I was watching him type and seeing that, you know, the way he enters his, uses the keyboard to get Xcode to do the code completion for him is really kind of cool. So definitely recommend, not only a good instructor on this stuff, and like he's, like I said, he just started publishing videos a couple of months ago. Let me see how far. Yeah, 2 weeks ago he started. So definitely keep an eye on this guy. I think he's got some, got a future. Oh no, I'm sorry. He's put up quite a few things. 5 months, 6 months. Oh, I take it back. He's been doing it for a while. But yeah, his Swift stuff is really good. He started doing these, it's called a series called Unlocking Swift. But yeah, check it out. I think he's going to be a contender. And my last pick is the Swift UI by Tutorials book has been updated. It's now in its third edition by the folks over at raywunderlich.com. As soon as I got my hands on it, I jumped down to the building a Mac. Chapter 20 talks about building a Mac app using Swift UI. So I jumped down there, and that's where I got all those tips about, I was telling about earlier about building preferences and how you, you know, use app storage and how you use how you build menus with tab bars, convert your, because you know when you develop a Mac app, like Macs traditionally are top down in terms of how you lay things out. You know, you've got your menus across the top and you've got usually your buttons are up in the tab bar and that kind of stuff. Whereas on iPad and iOS, we tend to put buttons down at the bottom. We have like a toolbar, that kind of thing, or you know, and how buttons are work as a metaphor great on iPad or iOS, but you know, they have a different kind of function in Mac development. Like one thing about Mac development is different than iOS development is on iOS, you normally you tap on something and it does something. Whereas on the Mac, you tend to use the mouse to select something and then perform an action on it, right? Which is kind of a different style, more slower style of working. So these articles on the Mac app are really good. I've got to go back through the rest of the book, but because I hadn't really read this book, to be honest with you, with these guys. But yeah, just checked out the jumped down to the chapter 20 on building a Mac app, which was really good. So yeah, highly recommend the new Swift UI by Tutorials third edition from the folks over at raywunderlich.com. And those are my picks, thoughts, questions.
Going back on one I should say, I'm pretty impressed with the layout here for the Apple developer one. They got a pretty nice sort of striking style here. I know we've seen that some of their newer stuff does the, okay, this section will take you 5 minutes, this one will take you 20, this is 15 minutes. That's really nice. So you'd kind of know what you're getting into. You can do, you know, bite-sized chunks, but just the style of stuff is actually pretty neat. And I think even if I blurred my eyes and wasn't looking at the text, I think I could sort of figure out what the content probably was, which tells me the iconography is really good.
And what's nice about it too is that I really like about this, I don't know how they're doing it, but it's like an HTML, CMS kind of, you know, magic, HTML5, I mean. There, as you're coding, as you scroll down the page and look at the code, it actually renders the preview like it would like on a canvas view in Xcode, right? So you can see what you're expecting to get in your own code, which I find really helpful, you know, for learning new concepts, right? So I don't know how what magic they're doing, some sort of web mojo that they're using, but it's really cool. Have you looked at any of the tutorials to see what I mean?
I haven't gone through them, but
yeah, just click on one and you'll see what I mean. Like, this takes a sec.
State management is probably going to be a good one.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Okay. So, oh, whoa, what was this? Oh, it showed me the preview. I was like, what is that coming out of the screen?
Yeah.
With my, see, if I had AR 3D glasses, it could be like, whoa, it's coming towards me. Giving you a little sort of popover of here's what you should see in the UI, which is neat.
Yeah, like as soon as you go to step two and it says add a rounded rectangle, you get this big black box, right?
Hmm.
And as you scroll down to the next piece of code, as it fills it in, this is not a good example.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you get down to step seven and the preview jumps out with the yellow box, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should go through these. I haven't done any Swift UI in a long time.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, you can turn the preview off too, but yeah, it's really, really kind of nice to have it sort of show you as you're going through the code what you're supposed to be getting, right?
Right. So, you know, if you screwed up. A lot of times with these tutorials, you'll be typing stuff in and you'll kind of get to a point where suddenly it's different.
Yeah.
And like, oh, where did I screw up?
It's funny. I know what you mean. Like sometimes you do that in the books and stuff like that, but these ones seem to be very well curated because if there's something going wrong, generally speaking, you did something wrong. mm-hmm. Like the other day I'm halfway through the UI kit one, and I did something the other day and I forgot to make an instance or an optional, right? And I'm looking at my code and looking at the screen, I'm looking at their example, I'm looking at the, I cannot for the life of me see the difference, right? And then, you know, so I paste it into BB Edit and then I do a diff on it and then I can say, oh, I forgot the question mark, right? But generally speaking, my code was wrong is what I'm saying, right? So
mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really surprised in this UI kit one that they're talking about table views.
Yeah, but you know what? It's what's interesting about it is that what I found was the first time I've sort of seen anything from Apple where they almost do like a model view model sort of style, right?
Right. But the reason that I'm surprised about table views is because they made such a big deal last year at WWDC
about the list and stuff.
About how the future is collection view list configurations.
Yeah.
Which I've adopted actually. They're pretty good. Although you have to think
is
about
that a
things.
New style of collection view, like a new design mode?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, totally it is. Yeah. It's built on top of compositional layout collection view.
Yeah.
And it basically makes the promise is that you can do anything you can do in a table view in one of these just as easily. Now I found there were a couple things that you couldn't do, but they've like one of them is it's promised in 14.5, but 14.5 doesn't seem to ever want to come out. Like changing the colors of the separators seems like a fairly obvious one, but that's not coming till 14.5. But anyway, one thing that it makes really, really simple to do is these accordion style lists where you can collapse things. Just with zero effort at all. You basically just make this object and add children to it. And once you do that, then you put that in a list. Then suddenly you have a cell with a nice tappable thing to open the accordion to show the children of this object. It's actually very nice, very easy. There's a couple of WWDC videos from last year on it that explain it pretty well. But as far as I can tell, you know, table views are over. They're
last year's news. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, like I said, because this set of tutorials, you know, it started out as Swift UI stuff, right? Because I went through the whole Swift UI one they did when it came out, and I went to this one this year. Like, this year's tutorial talks about building a Scrum timer, right? And records audio and that kind of stuff. It's kind of cool. So it goes through a whole bunch of different types of things you can do in Swift UI. But this UI kit one just showed up the other day, right? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So UI kit is not dead then.
UI kit is not dead.
The rumors are greatly exaggerated.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Oh, there's a little plus thing here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's a Swift UI and a UI kit tutorial. Yeah. Maybe next year they'll introduce Objective-C. Who knows?
Yeah, Objective-D.
Objective-S or Objective-X, and then we'll argue about how to pronounce it, right?
Right. Objective-10.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for another show. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devofthehair.
All right. Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
MarkR@snapsoft.com.
All right. And my name is Timitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye.
Tune into this podcast. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC, and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is at MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Did you know we recorded for 3.5 hours the other day, Jaime?
Did we really?
Yeah.
It was.
We almost beat Snyder.
Almost beat the Snyder cut. It was quite a bit to catch up on because we had, you know, a lot to go on for the Justice League Snyder cut. Yeah. We had WandaVision to try to recap. And then I think you went out to take Mac to pee while we talked about the Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite a time to edit it, too. It took me like more longer than a normal spot cut. Well, mind you, our Sparkcast episodes always end up being a little over 2 hours, right? I don't know if that turns people off or not.
It's less structured, so it's a little easier to get. Well,
but you know what? It's straightforward because it's easier to edit because it's just a conversation. We're not really, you know, we never really go anywhere that we shouldn't go and that kind of stuff, right?
Right, right.
So all good. It's all good, man.
Speaking of editing, tone down my negativity on the M1. I didn't really mean it to come out that way. I just started talking and realized, oh, shit.
I don't know that I took it as like a slam or too negative. I thought it was Tim, it's up to you how you hear it. When I heard it live, I was like, oh, this is a pretty good counterbalance to the just like fanboyism that's
it's
come
wonderful.
Out.
I'm
like,
hey,
this is realistic.
Yeah.
Like, it's good.
Right.
It didn't change my life, you know, but that's actually a pretty good win in my opinion.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is like, you know, in a lot of reviews you see, people take one side or the other, right? And they either slam the M1 or don't bother buying an M1, or at least that's the clickbaity lead title, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or they'll be, oh my God, you know, throw all your old Macs away kind of thing, right? Or the two styles of reviews you get, right? But that's why I like the Rennie Ritchie ones. He's pretty realistic about stuff too, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm definitely not unhappy with this thing at all. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's...
You made me regret having bought my 2020 MacBook Pro a little less with your review of the M1. So,
you know, okay.
Well, you get a bit of FOMO, right?
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. So I did something good. No, I don't regret it at all. I mean, for the price point, you know, I'm perfectly happy with it. It was pretty cheap. You know, this same thing probably would have cost, you know, over $2,000 if I bought the Intel version. So I'm not unhappy with it at all. It's just, it hasn't lived up to the, you know, the hype.
The hype.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. But it is an entry level machine. It's not meant to be meant to be like burning off your desk, right?
Right. You know, well, and floating. That's actually the best part of it. It generates no heat. It's not burning anything. It generates no heat. No heat.
It's funny, you know, because the other.
Okay, it's a little bit warm today because I am as I've been doing the Zoom call. I've also been crypto mining running Safari. Looking at the SwiftUI tutorials all at the same time. And it's getting a little bit warm to the touch. You know, my old machine would have been like a stove.
Flaming?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to say that it has a fan on the back too, doesn't it, Mark?
It does not have a fan. There's no fan.
Oh, because my DTK had a fan in it, and every now and then I would hear it like, and I would feel warm air coming out the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
So must have been a different style.
Yeah, being able to use your laptop back on your lap again, which has not been true for decade plus.
Yes,
it sounds like a dumb thing, but I'm like, it's probably a huge win, though, right? That you can just quietly use this?
Mine's a mini. No, it's not a laptop, but yes.
Yeah.
But yes. And by the way, when I say I'm crypto mining, I'm using 8 threads to crypto mine. So I'm running at like 800% of CPU here. And it's not generating any noticeable heat, which is really nice. So maybe I was a little harsh on it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have one, so I don't know. I hope to have one soon, but you know.
Well, they're not that expensive. All things considered.
And I've got the credit for the other one. I'm just hedging my bets to see what hardware Apple's going to come out with.
They will announce. I'm like 95% sure they'll announce the 16-inch, but they won't be out until September or October.
Yeah, yeah.
Coming up on the end of an era here, so I did the final transfer out of my Simple bank account prior to the May 8th transition to BBVA. So I did a really good job of realizing where the ACH velocities were for transfers. So did the final transfer, should deposit tomorrow. I'll give it another week and a half for ACH reconciliation. And then they actually have, as some folks told me, there's actually a little handy button in the web, not on mobile, where you can go into account settings and there's a close account button. I'm like, oh, I guess I'll do that.
For what?
Closing out my Simple account as the bank.
Oh, yeah.
The fintech no longer will exist and gets...
Oh, really?
You know, everybody's accounts gets... I mean, the money was always with BBVA, but you'll transition to a BBVA account if you hang around past May 8th.
So Simple is out of business?
Yeah, so PNC merged with BBVA USA, which is the parent company for Simple, Aslo, and a few other things. Mm. And apparently they didn't want any of that, so they're just shutting all that down, which is interesting. But yeah, it's coming up on the end of an era. When they made that announcement, I was like, oh man, I got to move truckloads of money out of here, knowing what I know about ACH velocities. And I know how to look and see what's going on. I'm like, okay, it's not really reverse engineering because it was engineered. I'm like, oh, let me see what's going on here. I was like, oh, okay, do the math in my head. It's like, all right, I have to just keep pushing the limits because there's a limit on how much you can do, you know, going outbound per day and outbound total per month. And I was just like, on a regular schedule, just get at the maximum amount every time it gives me the new fresh amount to pull out all the money, move it to other accounts, get my Apple card paid off with, you know, a different account, that sort of thing. I had to map out everything. I was like, okay, which accounts are connected to which? And okay. So these are the ones I need to move first to have an easier transition. So it was like a whole plan that I had.
Yeah. You know what I do with with 1Password is I put everything that's connected to 1Card in there. So if I ever lose a card or get stolen or whatever, I just quickly go and see where, you know, what's using it, using that card, right?
Oh, so you use a note to say like, all right, it'll be this, and this service.
I add a tag. You can add tags in 1Password, right?
Yeah, that's a good way of, I never thought of tags as a way. That's a good way to cross.
Yeah, somebody
things.
Pointed it out to me, like, because he had the same problem. He said, like, he uses tag. I stole that idea from him. So, you know, I have an RBC card, I have a TD card, you know, and I know which one goes to which. And so, like, you know, I've got a couple of cards that are getting renewed in June. So I'll have to go through and update the auto withdrawals or whatever if the number changes, right? Well, the expiry date will change, right? Yeah, so I'll have to go through and, you know, and the CVC number on the back and blah, blah, blah.
Is it WWDC 21 or WWDC 2021, which might be an actual Google search that people are looking
at? Or how about the Winds of Winter will be released at WWDC 21?
Winds of Winter?
You don't get the Winds of Winter reference? That's a long-awaited book 6 of the Game of Thrones
is it?
Series. Yeah, it's now, what, something like 15 years since book 5 came out?
Oh, really?
And the guy keeps saying, oh, I'm almost done. He's been saying that for 10 years now.
He's too busy like drinking champagne and stuff, right?
Yeah, probably.
He's doing side stuff. He's like, oh, I'm writing this prequel. Okay. I'm like, I'm doing this wolf thingy. I signed this.
Well, they melted the throne. What else? There is no Game of Thrones anymore. Didn't they melt the throne in the book?
Well, the book hasn't.
The TV show went ahead of the books, and it's pretty much universally agreed upon that the TV show ruined it. So, I mean, TV show was just awful at the end. Just awful. Mm-hmm. So I mean, the books ended roughly when like Arya showed up in the country in the east, right? That's when the books ended, and the Dorne stuff was just getting started. That's when the books ended. Mm. So all the rest of that they made up.
Oh, the stuff where Arian was going around killing all the people that she
none of that was in the books. Yeah, none of that was
in the books. It was not in the books.
Nope.
Oh, okay.
The wall coming down, although that was speculated on, was not in the books. Mm-hmm. Even Jon Snow was Rhaegar and Ned Snow's sister's son. That part was not in the books, but it was strongly hinted at, but never. Oh, even Jon Snow coming back to life still wasn't in the books. Hadn't happened yet. He died at the end of book five. Yeah, that's where book five ended. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, they just made up a huge amount of stuff. Yeah.
Hmm. So there's people holding out hope that they can get the true ending from the books
at the end of book seven, which is due around 2053, the year 2053, the way he's going. Yeah.
Wow. Yep. If he lives that long.
No, he won't live that long.
Yeah. He's too nice. It's evil that keeps you going for unreasonable amounts of time.
Right.
It's hate makes you powerful. But
right. Cool.
Yeah. We're getting ready for a fourth wave of COVID because people are being stupid again, like spring break.
Are you in a fourth wave? We're just starting our third. You guys are way ahead of us.
Yeah. Yeah. People are, I mean, there's just huge crowds of people partying down in Florida again. So it's just a race now. You know, can we vaccinate enough people before the stupid people all catch the disease and go home and spread it to everyone?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, that, you know, the sad part is if we all get vaccinated, it doesn't mean COVID's going to go away. It just means the effect of it. It's going to be less.
Right. We're unclear if we'll need a yearly flu shot kind of thing for COVID to get rid of the variants.
Well, based on the variants,
In theory, if you vaccinate enough people and isolate the people who do catch it, then you can pretty much eradicate it like they did with, you know, smallpox or polio.
Oh, okay. Right? Yeah.
But no one's claiming that's actually going to happen. It's just going to reduce the numbers a lot. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Mac needs to go outside.
Okay.
He's telling me.
All right.
So,
all right.
Well, should call
about
it
that time. Okay. Sounds good.
Later.
See you guys next time.
Yep. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.